Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one wants to imagine what it would look like, but North Korea's warning of total war in retaliation for any U.S. strike ratcheted tensions up yet another notch today. So far, it's only a war of words between Washington and Pyongyang, and everyone says they want a diplomatic solution. But North Korea and the United States are now flirting with the unthinkable. Tonight on Point, diplomatic deadlock and military nightmare on the Korean Peninsula. We begin with a report direct from the North Korean capital of Pyongyang. The secretive government there this week made an unusual opening, inviting in Western journalists, including the BBC's Mike Thompson. I asked Mike what the North Korean government wanted journalists like him to hear.
I'm still trying to work that out, to be honest with you. I think they feel they need friends. I think they feel they need some sort of influence as they watch what they see as the growing accumulation of U.S. forces in the region here. They feel that the world is against them. They feel, I think it's something almost historic with North Korea, that just about everybody is out to get them. And at the moment, with this nuclear row, this is the latest thing, and they think this may be used as an excuse to either invade them, which is what many people seem to think, they really do, or to bomb them. And so I think they're looking for journalists like myself to act as a sort of a mouthpiece for them, if you like, to say, this is what these people are thinking, this is what they want. But at the same time, access is sometimes a little bit difficult to some of the officials here. So I do wonder occasionally why the invitation was extended. But I think it was to try and get their views expressed across the world.
The language coming out of Pyongyang just in the last 24 hours is extremely hot, talking about total war, even preemptive strikes against U.S. troops. Not clear where that might be. Are you hearing this kind of language?
I am indeed. I spoke yesterday to the deputy director in the foreign ministry, Mr. Kim Pyong-gap, and he said to me that if American soldiers put one boot, as he put it, over the borderline between his country and South Korea, then there would be instant retaliation. And he said, in fact, because he believes, and his government believes, that the U.S. may be considering some sort of strike, preemptive strike against North Korea, he said, we are now considering that against U.S. forces. Now, he wasn't very specific about that, but I got the impression that it might indicate that his government is thinking of perhaps launching a missile somewhere at perhaps a U.S. air carrier or something like that, probably not in South Korea, because relations between the two countries have been improving. And I think his government's starting to feel that the South Koreans are getting friendlier and more interested in a unified Korea. And that's, of course, ultimately what they want.
How do you read this message, Mike Thompson? Is this bluster? Does North Korea have the capacity to deliver on that kind of threat? Do they have a real strategic interest in delivering on that kind of threat?
Well, it would seem to be completely mad, wouldn't it, to do any such thing? I mean, one, because it launch a preemptive strike against anybody is a little bit strange, but I think against the U.S. it would be pretty much suicide. But I think they do have the capacity to do that, and the regime here is so unpredictable. And so hard to read, and I've had that said to me by many diplomats who have spent years trying to deal with them, that I suppose it's always possible that they might do such a thing if they thought they could come under attack. And of course, they look back to 1994 when former President Clinton was thinking of launching a raid on the nuclear power plant then, when there was a big row going on about what they were doing to develop nuclear weapons. In the end, of course, President Clinton didn't go ahead with that. But they think this time that might happen. And they're sort of going on the idea that perhaps attack is the best form of defense. But having said that, I do believe that a lot of this is bluster. I think it's a feeling that at the moment the U.S. is occupied with Iraq, but as soon as the Iraq question is dealt with, the full attention of the U.S. And our allies will turn towards North Korea. And I think once that happens, they'll get very few concessions about the whole nuclear issue. So they're trying to, I think, shock America into doing what they really want, which is to sign this non-aggression treaty before the whole nuclear question is dealt with. And obviously the U.S. is looking like it's not going to do that.
Why is a non-aggression treaty so important to North Korea now? It's been many years since the shooting war stopped, post-Korean War. Why now this great urgency and interest?
Well, I think they realize that the Americans and the rest of the world is very worried about their possible development of nuclear weapons, although they deny that they are doing that. And I think that they seem to believe that if they have that agreement now, that even if they are producing nuclear weapons, then at least they can feel pretty sure that it's something they can negotiate over and they won't face any possible strike. Whereas I think they believe that once Iraq is dealt with, the U.S. may decide simply to take this plant out rather than negotiate much further. And I think they just feel that gives them a guarantee. That gives them a guarantee under international law that if the U.S. did launch a strike, it would be internationally condemned. And it's just a sort of a long-term security measure that I think is tied into this whole nuclear issue and is less to do with former hostilities of the 1950s.
But couldn't North Korea avert that kind of strike simply by pulling back from their nuclear program? It wouldn't require a treaty. In fact, pulling back might be more effective than a piece of paper, however signed.
That would seem to be the logical thing to do. I mean, they keep telling me that their problem is they're facing a severe power shortage, not least, of course, because after the U.S. Accused them of breaking this long-standing agreement, this agreed framework that dates back to 1994 on the nuclear issue, they feel their energy problems have got worse and worse and worse, and indeed many of their factories here can't run because there isn't the power. There are often blackouts here because of power failures. So they're saying they really do need the energy, and they believe or they make out that nuclear power is the best way they can get that. And, of course, at this time of the year, it is extremely cold. The river outside my hotel window here is completely frozen, a very large river, and to show how cold it is. And they need to be able to heat the country. And they're saying they simply don't, at the moment, have the fuel. And without the U.S. oil that they were getting up to the end of last year, the situation is getting critical. And they point out this is the only way they can have some sort of independence power-wise.
So plenty of fear, plenty of bluster, and maybe a real threat in all that. Mike Thompson, we don't often get to speak to someone who's sitting in Pyongyang. What's it like? Is there a mood there that you can detect, or just empty streets? Give us a flavor.
Well, the streets are, in the main, pretty empty. The only crowded place I found really has been the subway system. And if you go down there about 9 o'clock, there is a sort of a Pyongyang rush hour, strangely enough. But it's a rather, obviously, this time of year, very cold, very grey place, a bit like you picture sort of Soviet bloc countries, certainly going back a decade or so, very much like that. And there are some very eerie air raid sirens that keep breaking out, and people rush off to air raid shelters under command from speakers that sound all around the city. And there are blackouts that aren't just because of power failures. They're practicing for bombing, and they're having people close their curtains. Cars are supposed to get off the road so the headlights don't shine. It's a real siege mentality here. There's a lot of tangible nervousness on the streets, very, very twitchy at the moment.
And finally, Mike Thompson, will you come away feeling that anything could happen there?
Yes, I think that is my feeling. The people here, they really do believe that something is going to happen. They've lived under this siege mentality for a long time. But they really do seem to be a nation on the edge. And with the government here so hard to predict, it does leave me with a feeling that really anything could happen here.
Mike Thompson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Thompson is a BBC correspondent. He spoke with us 1 hour ago from Pyongyang, North Korea. In 1950, in a notorious miscalculation, General Douglas MacArthur boasted he could triumph in Korea, quote, with one hand tied behind his back. 3 terrible years and nearly 100,000 30,000 U.S. dead and wounded later, the Korean War ended in stalemate. North Korea has never been a predictable enemy for the United States. Now, after years of famine and economic crisis, and in the face of a hard line from the Bush administration, Pyongyang appears more desperate, and desperate to take advantage of U.S. involvement in Iraq to strike a new relationship with Washington, even at the risk of war. No one wants armed conflict, but tensions are spiraling. Can you imagine a new Korean War, a second front? Could we tumble accidentally into war on the Korean Peninsula? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Daryl Press, a professor of government at Dartmouth College, who has worked for years as a consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense and has closely studied strategic interests and options in Northeast Asia. Good evening and welcome, Daryl Press.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. General Press, we suddenly feel like we need to understand a lot more on the military side of the equation in North Korea. Everyone would like to see it solved diplomatically. Everyone continues to say so, but the language around the military option, which is always hot out of North Korea, is now hot sometimes out of Washington as well. We're talking about potentially moving new U.S. military assets closer to the Korean Peninsula. Can you give us a sense here of what kind of scenarios people are concerned about? The stakes are very high. It's nuclear weapons production we're talking about. North Korea's deep strategy, as we understand it, is in fact one of preemptive strike, even before the U.S. turned to that kind of strategy. Is that a real risk here? Is it absurd to think North Korea might strike first? Is there any way that the U.S. could strike at North Korea's nuclear facilities without unleashing a holocaust on South Korea?
Well, I wouldn't call it absurd, the idea that the North Koreans could attack first, but I think it's unlikely. It's principally unlikely because the North Koreans are a lot weaker militarily than they pretend to be. They have a really huge military. They've got a very large army, and it's stationed right near South Korea. Mm-hmm. But it's also an army that's equipped with very old weapons. It's an army that lacks the money and the fuel to do a lot of realistic training. So I think the odds of them actually starting a new Korean War are low. But as everybody points out, because they're so desperate, you can't guarantee that. You can't predict that entirely.
Strange things are in the air. Among them, we heard this afternoon speculation about North Korea attempting to drop a missile on U.S. troops, not even in South Korea, but in Japan, to kind of drive a new wedge into the whole scenario and change all the strategic interests there. Are they that desperate? Are they that, close to the edge?
Well, it's impossible to know what they're going to do or how they're going to react through desperation. But I think the scenario of them attacking U.S. forces in Japan, if they were going to attack any U.S. forces, is probably one of the more likely scenarios, partly because the idea, which some people in the news have talked about, of them attacking a U.S. aircraft carrier would be much more difficult. It's very difficult to find them on the high seas. And for diplomatic reasons, they might prefer to attack the Japanese than to attack the South Koreans. So all of this seems kind of implausible. All of this seems unlikely. But as people keep pointing out, when you're dealing with a country that is as desperate as North Korea, you really can't count on anything.
And when the U.S. is watching the potential development of nuclear weapons, not just one or two, but a potential, essentially a factory for nuclear weapons, we had General Wesley Clark on just a couple of weeks ago, and earlier former Clinton administration officials who had been through the 1994 crisis, who said that there had been military plans there. And Wesley Clark said that in his view, the U.S. did have military options even now to strike at this nuclear facility in Yongbyon. Can you imagine that? How could that work without bringing a rain of shells down on Seoul?
Well, I think the U.S. does have military options. And in fact, if we wanted to, we could probably conduct a preemptive attack that did a great deal of damage to the North Korean nuclear weapons program. But there are huge problems that would arise. The first one is there's absolutely no guarantee that we would destroy whatever bombs they've already created. That would be the hardest part of the strike, mm-hmm. trying to find whatever bombs they already have. The second problem is through these sorts of attacks, you can slow, but it's very difficult to stop a country's nuclear weapons program. The biggest difficulties, however, are that, number one, North Korea holds Seoul and, to a lesser extent, Tokyo under threat. And if the United States attacked North Korea's nuclear weapons program, there's very, very little we could do to stop the North Koreans from using just conventional weapons, artillery pieces, and shelling Seoul and doing a tremendous amount of damage.
Doesn't that essentially rule out a U.S. military option, even though some generals like to talk about it?
In my view, it would take extraordinarily extreme circumstances before the United States would take a preemptive attack against North Korea's nuclear facilities for exactly that reason.
We're going to come back and talk about whether or not we're approaching extraordinary circumstances. We're looking tonight at the diplomatic crisis and military threat on the Korean Peninsula. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Can you imagine a new Korean War? Is North Korea all bluff? Can we call North Korean nukes a bluff? And is Washington all bluff when it calls Pyongyang a terrorist regime, a threat on the axis of evil? Join us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about diplomatic crisis and military threat on the Korean Peninsula. Could we tumble accidentally into war on the Korean Peninsula? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Professor Daryl Press of Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He's a consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense. We're joined now by Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program and senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a longtime foreign correspondent with deep history and experience in Asia and Northeast Asia, author of Korean Endgame. Good evening and welcome, Selig Harrison.
How are you?
Very well. Thank you for joining us. Selig Harrison, no one wants to see anything like a real military situation arise in Northeast Asia, and yet we're talking about the manufacture of nuclear weapons, about the movement of U.S. military forces, North Korea raising the rhetorical language, if nothing else. Are we flirting with an extraordinary level of danger here, or is this all bluff in front of a diplomatic background?
No, there is a lot of danger, but let's keep in perspective what's happened. They're not the only ones who've used a lot of rhetoric. This week, Secretary Rumsfeld announced what really got this whole North Korean outburst started is when Secretary Rumsfeld said we were going to send new airplanes offshore North Korea to be in position.
This is the dozen B-52s and dozen B-1s,
right,
to Guam.
We said that's to deter North Korea from trying anything. But in their minds, this was an implicit threat of preemptive action against their nuclear capability, because we had put out stories of spy satellites seeing suspicious activity, their reprocessing center at Yongbyon.
Mm-hmm.
So in their minds, this was a move in the direction of preemptive action. And so you got two quick responses. And then at the same time, Secretary Armitage said on Tuesday,
yes,
that we weren't in any hurry to negotiate with North Korea. We might do it after the new government in South Korea comes in in late February, and, you know, that could mean March. And so here they are, some of the earlier speakers have said, shivering in Pyongyang, desperately trying to get some kind of energy help from the United States. And we're sort of la-di-da, and then talking about airplanes going into the vicinity of North Korea. So they did two things. They restarted the reactor, and then they made these statements that two can play the game of preemption. And, of course, this preemption business is really the root of the whole situation in Korea, because the Bush administration's attitude, a posture, national security doctrine that we are entitled to take preemptive action in general, not just against North Korea,
yes,
against countries we consider a potential threat, really had a powerful impact in Pyongyang. They have feared preemptive military action by the U.S. For a long time, but this magnified it. So,
and this was a formal change of U.S. policy and
not
public.
Not only a formal change, but we just threw out 50 years of U.S. nonproliferation and arms control policy. If you assert that right, the nonproliferation treaty, which we make such a fuss about, doesn't have much meaning if we have the right to take preemptive military action against anybody we want to. So I think that North Korea, this is a very dangerous situation. You could have a challenge and response, and you could drift into a conflict situation.
And then, of course, just today, Celia Harrison, Secretary of State Colin Powell, said on Capitol Hill that no options have been taken off the table, including the military option, although we have no intention of attacking North Korea as a nation, interestingly, he said, or invading North Korea. And, of course, this week also Donald Rumsfeld calling the regime in Pyongyang a terrorist regime, which in other parts of the world means open season.
Look, the last thing North Korea wants is a war, because they know that people in Washington who would like to see the collapse of the North Korean regime will use any excuse they can get to stage military action that will be designed not just to deal with the nuclear reactor, but to deal with North Korea as a state. You know, President Bush, who must have thought he was just talking to Bob Woodward when he gave the interview for his for Woodward's book, Bush at War, said, "I loathe Kim Jong-il,
right,
and I'd like to topple the regime." Now, you know, if that's your stated view, it's pretty hard, not here at the other end, and you're a little country of 22 million people with terrible economic problems, no more patrons like Russia and China bailing you out economically. You hear that?
That sounds pretty tough.
Loudly.
Darrell Press, I want to bring you back in. This notion, there is a group of hawks in Washington, Celia Harrison asserts, and he's not the only one, who would like to see North Korea fall, who believed in the Bush administration it would fall under its own weight, who perhaps, Celia Harrison says, would not be so unhappy to see a military confrontation there. But where does that option lie that doesn't leave a half million, a million dead South Koreans, not to mention anybody else who might be taken down?
I agree with the premise of the question, which is there are plenty of people in Washington who would like to see the North Korean regime fall quicker, fall now, in fact. But, you know, talking to people on the military side of this, I don't think there is anybody who thinks that this war can be waged on the cheap, especially from the perspective of the South Koreans. I've never heard anybody who is associated with the Pacific Command or who's associated with military planning for the U.S. military who thinks that the United States could win this war without a lot of South Korean civilians paying the price.
But will they hold out on that front if North Korea continues to ratchet this up? We understand they want to come to a new understanding with the United States while the Iraq threat is real and imminent and looming. Washington Post quoting this week Japanese foreign ministry officials saying that they fear that North Korea will continue to increase the stakes to the point possibly even of testing a nuclear weapon it may already have. Could the U.S. military, could Washington be pushed to a military confrontation despite those terrible stakes?
I think anything is possible, and the pressures on the Bush administration to act with military force if the North Koreans detonate a nuclear weapon as a test would be tremendous. But at the end of the day, what the Bush administration would have to ask itself is what sort of a cost is it willing to pay in the currency of its alliance with the South Koreans and in the currency of its alliance with the Japanese in order to conduct what would probably be marginally effective attacks against the broad North Korean nuclear weapons program.
Sounds very unappetizing. Darrell Press, Celia Harrison, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. John's calling. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Yes. I do not see that there is any alternative but to launch a military strike if the Koreans continue to develop nuclear weapons. Supposedly they have one or two now. How much worse is their situation going to be when they get eight and perhaps dozens later on? They will proliferate them because they need the money. They will make the Middle East more dangerous if they are proliferated there. I see it as an extremely dangerous situation.
But, John, 11,000 artillery pieces are aimed at Seoul where millions of people lived. Can we really risk a strike on Yongbyon, on the nuclear processing plant, if all those South Koreans, not to mention everybody else, U.S. troops and the rest, are at risk once we cross that line?
It's a terrible, terrible price. How much of a price will we pay once nuclear weapons are proliferated all over the world?
But I think the point we have to remember
Harrison.
Is that North Korea is ready to trade in that nuclear program if the economic price is high enough. They, there is a strong hawkish faction in North Korea. It's stronger now than it was in 1994. I've been there seven times, and I've watched with horror since 1994 the moderates in North Korea losing the argument because they say, look, the hawks say, look, in 1994 we made a deal with the U.S. To freeze our nuclear program. They got up front what they wanted. We froze our nuclear program in 1994, and what did we get? some oil shipments. And the other things we were supposed to get, a complete reversal of the relationship with the U.S. and friendly relations, we didn't get. So the hawks are stronger in North Korea. But
Celia Harrison, just last October, we're told Colin Powell was ready to go to Pyongyang with a bold new initiative, and instead they found evidence of a secret nuclear program. That doesn't sound too good.
But they also found the North Koreans telling them at the same time that we confronted them with that evidence. And, of course, the North Koreans did cheat. After 4 or 5 years of not getting what they thought they were going to get from the 1994 agreement, when the Pakistanis came to them and said, we're going to give you this, you're giving us these missiles, we can't pay you cash, but we'll give you uranium. They did a very unfortunate thing, and they hedged their bets by starting this uranium program. But when we confronted them with the evidence, they also said, look, you've got the goods on us, but we're willing to end this.
So why haven't we bought that shit, Celia Harrison?
Because
the nukes are so terrifying.
They're hung up on the idea that we're the only superpower, and for us to deal with North Korea as if it's an equal state is just not, just doesn't fit the atmosphere of the Bush period, where we're the guys who are supposed to be running the world.
John, thank you for your call. Celia Harrison, Darrell Press, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago, author of many books on Korea, including Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. Good evening and welcome, Bruce Cummings.
Thank you.
Bruce Cummings, put this in perspective for us. Celia Harrison is describing a kind of misapprehension on both sides of the other, and in his view, particularly in Washington, of what's going on in North Korea. There's a terrible sense of deja vu here. We misread the Korean Peninsula pretty badly in the Korean War. Is there any echo here in your mind of the great power of Washington not reading Korea well?
Well, I don't think Washington has ever read the Korean situation very well. 57 Februarys ago, Kim Jong-il's father came to effective power in February 1946, and we still haven't found a way to deal with that regime. To recognize it or to normalize relations with it. We had a tremendous responsibility for the coming of the war in 1950.
Remind us why.
First of all, because we unilaterally divided Korea at the 38th parallel in August 1945 without consulting anyone, not even our allies, let alone any Koreans. We then built a government based primarily on people who had served the Japanese and their colonial regime, particularly the police and military forces. And we also knew of an extraordinarily volatile situation within the country with guerrillas, peasant rebellions, and tremendous conflict along the border in the year before the Korean War started, or the Korean War that we know started. So there's a grave American responsibility going back to that very early and defining period.
Have we missed opportunities in the years since, and particularly in the last decade?
Well, we missed an opportunity to put an end to the war after 1953.
To formally end it instead of leaving it hanging, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's an armistice.
And there's a DMZ, and it's got a million and more troops around it.
Yeah, it's been one of the most volatile flashpoints in the world for 50 years, and our inability to solve that problem is a disgrace diplomatically in terms of our foreign policy. But a decade ago, we had what we're having now is a rerun of the crisis that happened a decade ago, where the North Koreans feel the only way they can bring themselves to our attention is to rattle their nuclear program, and they've sort of fast-forwarded that for the last 3 months, trying to get the Bush administration to deal with them. But Celia Harrison is right. What they want is a negotiation. And in 1994, we had a negotiation that mothballed their reactor for 8 years under international inspectors that were there right until they were booted out again last December.
Should we be negotiating now, or would that be submitting to blackmail, Bruce Cummings?
Well, all of our allies want us to negotiate, and particularly South Korea, which is often left out of this. I mean, South Korea far more important than we are in the Korean equation, and they're the ones that the bombs are going to fall on if this situation gets out of hand. I think we should let the South Koreans take the lead on this and not think that we're the only people that know what the right thing is to do in Korea. And if we do follow their lead, there will be a negotiation, and we will be able to negotiate the North Koreans out of both of their nuclear programs.
Bruce Cummings, it's terrific to have you, and we want to have you back soon to talk in more depth about that Korean War as this surges forward. But thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Bruce Cummings is professor of history at the University of Chicago. Selig Harrison?
Yes.
We hear about an aircraft carrier joining forces already in the area, about the U.S. troops being bumped up in South Korea, about these bombers being put forward. But where is the negotiation? Is there something going on that we don't hear about, or is it still frozen?
It's really frozen because, you know, both sides, the North Koreans say that things have to happen simultaneously, with neither side being forced to blink first. And the U.S. says, no, you've got to dismantle your entire nuclear program before we will even talk to you. Now, that, I think, is a very, talk about a maximum bargaining position. It makes no sense at all. We do have to get them, we can't negotiate completely without preconditions. We have to get them to promise, I would think, to stop, not to reprocess the plutonium, the fuel rods at Yongbyon that we've spotted them moving around in the last week or so by a satellite photographer, not to reprocess that into plutonium. And that's the only thing I think that's a reasonable condition, because that's the urgent threat. That's something that they could turn into plutonium very quickly, and we've got to ask them, we'll talk to you, and we'll give you the things in the negotiation that you're asking, a joint declaration, not really a treaty that would have to go to Congress, which would commit us not to attack a non-nuclear North Korea.
And so we wonder why that's not happening right now. Stan's calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
You got quite a panel here to discuss with tonight. I have a little bit of a vested interest. My brother-in-law is lives in South Korea. He was in the military in Vietnam, and then he went to Korea, and he married a Korean girl, and they lived in the United States for a little while. He just moved over there.
So, do you fear a military confrontation there, Stan, or not?
Yes, I think I study. You know, we have these debates when he's home, and I don't see how the United States, we're already technically fighting a three-front war now. And military...
Three fronts, how are you counting, Stan?
Well, you've got Iraq, you've got Afghanistan, and now you're moving into... You just said there's bombers and there's aircraft carriers already over there.
You think it's more than the U.S. military can handle?
Absolutely more. I got a 16-year-old son who they talk in history class every day about going into the draft. And I don't know how much more a non-volunteer army is going to be able to handle.
Stan, thank you for your call. Daryl Press, I want to put that to you. North Korea has said repeatedly that they fear that the United States is just kind of fobbing them off, wanting to deal with Iraq first, and then they fear the U.S. will turn militarily to look at them. Do you see the United States playing a kind of rope-a-dope game here, where it doesn't want to get into talks with North Korea too soon, that it wants to buy time, deal with Iraq, and then turn up the military heat on Pyongyang?
I think in some sense that's right, that we would clearly like to deal with these problems one at a time. At the same time, I think even if the Iraq situation is solved, I don't think the United States has military options for dealing with the problem. I really agree wholeheartedly with Selig Harrison that the only way to stop this is diplomatically. I think there's, on a somewhat different point, there's an irony to the Bush administration policy here. They're acting toward North Korea right now as if they really believe sincerely in deterrence. The kind of the way that they're being so uncompromising with North Korea suggests that people in the administration believe sincerely that because we are so strong and the South Koreans are relatively strong and the North Koreans are relatively weak, that North Korea won't dare start anything. And the irony is that this is the same administration which is deeply, deeply ambivalent about deterrence and, in fact, uses this argument to say why we can't deter Saddam Hussein, why he's too crazy, why we must have this war there.
Condoleezza Rice said this week, maybe just last night, that our options are fewer in Pyongyang. The suggestion seemed to be this is why we need to get into Baghdad. We don't want to create another potential nuclear-armed or weapons-of-mass-destruction-armed foe.
Yeah, it's true, but the things limiting us in Korea are not simply the nuclear weapons. North Korea has a great biological and chemical weapons capability, as well as a capability to really damage South Korea with conventional forces.
We'll come back and talk about that. We're looking tonight at the diplomatic crisis and military threat on the Korean Peninsula with Daryl Press and Selig Harrison. You can join the conversation. Could we tumble accidentally into war on the Korean Peninsula? Do we really have the capacity for war on two fronts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about diplomatic crisis and military threat on the Korean Peninsula. Has Washington been too hard or too soft with North Korea? Should we be hawks or diplomats here? And I guess, are we playing chicken with the lives of millions of South Koreans? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Dartmouth College by Daryl Press, professor of government and consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense, and by Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program and senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Right now we're joined on the line from Green Bay, Wisconsin by Brett. Hi, Brett. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to ask the speakers if they believe that our government is capable of having a limited nuclear war. I was in the Air Force and worked on the cruise missile and was personally told from the colonel that they believed in a limited nuclear war, and that was back in 1977.
In any particular theater, Brett, or just anywhere they needed it?
No, at the time, Jimmy Carter was giving away the Panama Canal, and they were pretty upset, the military, about it. So they were, his scenario, the colonel and me were in the room together, and he was saying that, what's the difference if I drop a bomb on Panama, then use a million guys to lose their lives? So,
Brett, let me put that to Selig Harrison. Selig Harrison, is that just barroom talk in the military, or is there, in fact, a limited military exchange scenario here?
Well, there certainly was. We had tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea that were intended to be used for very limited purposes, which President Bush Sr. pulled out in 1991. And there was a whole doctrine that Henry Kissinger once espoused. I was editor of the New Republic. We ran an article by a critic of that doctrine, which was called Limited War or Limited Annihilation. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's feasible, and I don't think they're talking. I don't think the people who want to take military action in North Korea are thinking of a nuclear strike. I think they're simply thinking of, they have the idea that a surgical conventional strike can be accomplished without precipitating a wider war, but I don't agree with that. I think they do something like that, then they're going to find U.S. bases in Japan, I would think, is the most likely option.
That is, North Korea's missiles capable of hitting U.S. bases in Japan?
Sure.
Do they have that range and accuracy?
The targeting is terrible. They haven't demonstrated very good targeting, but it does appear that they could put conventionally tipped missiles. They could probably hit a U.S. carrier or some of our air bases in Japan.
And the point is there, they don't want to kill fellow Koreans. They don't like the Japanese much anyway, and they certainly would be looking for a way to hit the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole scenario is crazy because I think the North Koreans, the last thing they want is to get into a war. It would only be through a terrible, really a complete failure of U.S. diplomacy that we would get into this situation. They're not going to start it.
But do you fear that the United States is playing a kind of rope-a-dope? I put the same question to Daryl Press. Delaying, you know, bluffing, waiting for Iraq to get behind us so Washington can approach Pyongyang from a more muscular, undistracted position.
The problem, I live in Washington, and let me tell you, this administration is completely paralyzed in its Korea policy. There's a group in the administration who really would like to get rid of North Korea. They think it shouldn't be there. And it's we should be starving it. We should be putting economic pressure on it. We should bring about its collapse. And Bush was expressing that view in his interview with Bob Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
And the other people in the administration aren't determined enough to really challenge this. And I don't think there is a U.S. policy. I think they're floundering, and that's what makes me so concerned about this.
Can I jump?
They don't have a game plan.
Daryl Press, please.
I want to jump back to Brett's question for a second because
it's
horrifying.
Tactical nuclear attack.
Exactly, because as horrifying as it sounds, I don't think Brett's question is entirely far-fetched, and let me explain what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Selig is undoubtedly right that if for some crazy reason the United States decided to attack North Korea's nuclear weapons program, it would be with conventional weapons.
Mm.
The question in my mind is this. How will North Korea retaliate? And if North Korea retaliates with a major war in the Korean Peninsula, we would like to keep that conventional, but North Korea might use huge stocks of chemical and biological weapons to try to shatter the South Korean army. And if they
do
that,
as you say, they don't have depth, so their strategy calls for everything they've got right away.
That's certainly true. And the only question in my mind is whether everything they've got includes their huge stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. Mm-hmm. If they did that, and if they succeeded in inflicting a very serious blow to the South Korean army, I think then all bets are off. And it's just, in my mind, an absolutely open question what lengths we'd go to stop the North Koreans from overrunning South Korea. Mm-hmm. Because if this is a conventional war, this is not a huge problem. There's no doubt in my mind that the United States military and the South Korean military together can easily defend South Korea from the North. But if the North Koreans lead off a war with a huge biological and chemical strike, it will raise the most serious questions at the highest levels of the U.S.
government. It is just an unthinkable scenario. In 1994, we are told the U.S. was ready to act preemptively. What did that look like, Darrell Press? What would that attack have been? Ashton Carter's been on and said, we had a plan.
Well, you know, the specifics of the plan are obviously highly classified, but the broad outlines can be reasoned out. It would undoubtedly be a combination of air and missile strikes against a whole range of targets at the Yongbyon facility mm-hmm. and other facilities. So if we're trying to do this in a way that doesn't implicate our allies, these strikes could be carried out from a combination of long-range bombers from Guam and maybe even from the United States and cruise missile strikes from naval vessels.
Sheila Harrison, we've just got 30 seconds more. What if you were master of the world, what step should come next to defuse this?
Well, the Bush administration should say to North Korea, we're willing to talk to you and give you a no-attack pledge, provided it's linked to denuclearization. And you have to, during the negotiations, give a formal public pledge that you will not reprocess the fuel rods at Yongbyon. I think that deal would fly. They blinked first when Jimmy Carter got his freeze in 1994. They imposed a unilateral immediate freeze when Carter left Pyongyang. So what they need is a face-saving way to do that.
It might work again. Maybe we'll try it. Sheila Harrison, thank you much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Sheila Harrison is author of Korean Endgame. And Darrell Press at Dartmouth College, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Darrell Press is professor of government at Dartmouth College. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. In a moment, travel writer Pico Iyer takes us inside North Korea. This is On Point. Despite all the recent headlines, North Korea itself remains a deep mystery to most of the world outside. In 1990, world wanderer and travel writer Pico Iyer traveled to North Korea and wrote about his time there in a book called Falling Off the Map, Some Lonely Places of the World. Lonely places are not just geographically isolated, says Iyer, but places that consider themselves odd men out, that live by their own laws on the margins of the global village. We caught up with Pico Iyer this week to review his experience in North Korea and ask why it qualifies as one of the world's loneliest places.
Almost the archetypal lonely place for me was North Korea, because we hear nothing about it, we seldom meet a North Korean. It's almost as if it exists in a parallel universe. There's an enormous Olympic stadium for a country that's never held the Olympic Games. There was a 101-story tourist hotel for a country that really doesn't have any tourists. There was a single lane in every street that was reserved only for the president, and yet that seemed pointless because all the roads were empty. And as I was driving around, I really felt as if I was moving through a brochure. I've never been to a place that looks so much like a photograph, which is to say, spotless and entirely without life and entirely without people. In all the days I was there, I never saw anyone walking randomly down the road. I never saw somebody crossing a street. I never really saw a person doing a human activity. Occasionally, I'd see large groups of them being herded around, maybe 50 to 100 people, almost the way you see kindergartners being led around. And so there was this very haunted sense of walking through a ghost country. And in that sense, it was lonely in the sense that one didn't see anything anywhere. And it was lonely in a deeper sense, because in all my travels, in those days I'd go to a lot of far-off places, to Vietnam and Cuba and China and Tibet. But in all those places, whenever you go there, you meet people who have slipped through the system, who want to make contact with foreigners. There's always a kind of underground ripple from the people who don't want to abide by their system. North Korea was the only place where there was none of that. And it seemed very lonely in the sense that I couldn't imagine anyone there even being able to imagine a country like America or Britain or Japan, let alone wanting to make contact with it. There are no foreign magazines or newspapers, no access to foreign television. It's completely sealed and extremely efficiently sealed to the point where it really seems to be spinning by itself in space. And I remember when I came back from North Korea after that trip, I thought that in some ways it was the most dangerous country that I'd been, not because the people were threatening, but just because it was as if they couldn't conceive of life as we knew it. And it's much easier to be aggressive to an abstraction than to anyone who has a human face. When I got on the plane in California to head towards North Korea, I had a strong sense of what human life is, what reality is, how the world works. And as soon as I got there, everything I knew I had to throw out of the window. And I sensed that they were as unable to understand me as I would be able to understand them. And yet very much geared at every moment towards nothing more than just the affirmation of the single leader's will. I remember one of the most striking things for me there was that in all these main, empty, silent, carless boulevards, they had loudspeakers, and every morning at 6 in the morning, the loudspeakers would blast out, "We are living in a socialist paradise, and Kim Il-sung is the greatest leader in the world." Everyone in North Korea in those days was allowed a radio, but all the radios were fixed so that all they would hear when the radios came on, as they did forcibly every morning in people's houses, was, "We are living in a socialist paradise, and Kim Il-sung is the greatest leader in the world." So there's no sense even that they would get underground cables, information, anything is possible there, because it's so effectively sealed, like nothing on earth. This is an excerpt from my book, Falling Off the Map, subtitled Some Lonely Places of the World, and this is just a passage from my days in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. At the Pyongyang Koryo Hotel, which is 45 stories high, I was led into an elevator that was as naked as an interrogation chamber, save for some overhead cleek lights. Then I was taken to my deluxe room. This was a four-room suite, almost entirely bare. One of its chambers was naked even of a trash can. The refrigerator next to the wall was likewise empty. The hotel was rich, however, in mirrors. There were mirrors in every passageway, huge four-sided pillars of mirrors in the lobby, 94 mirrors in the hangar-like dining room. It was a curious place, but comfortable. There was a calendar on the wall featuring four important dates in the life of Kim Il-sung. There was a black-and-white TV on which children could be seen reciting slogans. And though there was no lock on my door, it was graced by a five-digit number. It's going to be a long 3 weeks, a UN official was saying as I went into the dining room for dinner. Today they took me to the botanical garden and showed me all the plants named after Kim Il-sung, even all the bloody plants planted by Kim Il-sung. He had not, I gathered, seen Kim Jong-ilia, named after the son of Kim. Like every closed country around the world, from Yemen to Bhutan, North Korea was teeming with these types, UN men and development aides, acronymed bigwigs and troubleshooters. Now they were seated in the dining room, German and Chilean and African, many in their most formal gear, surrounded by 94 reflections of themselves and picking at some grizzled rainbow trout. Around me, a familiar chorus rose up. "They're very nice, these people, but totally hopeless. Their problem is they're over-enthusiastic, but you can't tell them that, of course." Later, standing in the shadow of the 70-foot bronze statue of the, quote, "peerless patriot and national hero," my guide extended a sweeping arm across the whole Orwellian skyline. At first, he explained, we didn't know how to make buildings and sculptures. We tried, but it was not beautiful. But we tried, and we tried again. Now look. I mumbled something about the economic costs of such monumentalism. He looked incredulous. "How can you say our economy is weak when we have all this?" Kim Il-sung had built up the whole nation out of the rubble of war. Having begun with a tabula rasa, he had enjoyed the rare opportunity to construct an entire nation in his image, stamped over with his monogram. "Now," my guide went on, 50,000 new flats were going to be completed in honor of the son of the nation's 80th birthday in 1992. It fell, appropriately enough, on Income Tax Day. That might also be the occasion when he handed over power to his son, dear comrade Kim Jong-il, or One Right Way Kim, as my guide translated the name. Enemy propagandists say that this is a family dynasty, he explained. But we need a leader just like Kim Il-sung, who better than his son?
Pico Iyer, reading from his 1993 book, Falling Off the Map, Some Lonely Places of the World. Pico Iyer's new book, just out, is called Abandon. For more information on Pico Iyer and his work, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is